Discussions with Ajahn Chichen in Negombo, Sri Lanka, October 2015, recorded and edited by Jonathan and Sarah. Speakers include Kevin Fong, Venerable Pandita, Huang, Nina, John, Sarah, Anne, Thampak, and Nopadom.
I'd just like to briefly introduce, this is Venerable U Pandita from Burma. And Venerable Pandita is very knowledgeable in Pali and Abhidhamma. And this is Fong, our old friend from Vietnam, who is studying in Sri Lanka at the moment and who has arranged some of the English discussions we'll be having.
We just come a long way to be here to meet you, and thank you for having this valuable time with us. I wish you, Ajahn and Nina, good health, and everybody good health. And then we just come here for, discussing the Buddha's words. Maybe I will start with a topic first. I've been participating in many discussions, and it's always a big question for me when you seem to value a lot paramattha dhamma, whereby panyati, according to my understanding, your view is such a wrong view. But my understanding is the two realities, they coexist, and then whether we contemplate on them or not, they do exist. If we know panyati, is also we know the realities. The first question is why you highly value paramattha dhamma and kind of undermine the understanding of panyati. Second question is probably I've heard this so many times about your interpretation of meditation as a wrong understanding of a technique. And if one tries something by ways of a technique, is he collects wrong view with the wrong idea of self, then it seems that we negate the whole tradition of learning the Buddha's words and practicing the Buddha's teaching. How can we, just by hearing, considering the Dhamma, can develop understanding? Thank you. And then probably Bhante will have more questions, but at least that this is the first time he hears such a discussion, so probably he would wait until he gets the idea a little clearer before he can pose questions. And I would really appreciate if Ajahn or Nina or the friends can help us to elaborate the two points. Thank you.
What do you think about the words of the Buddha? Is it very easy to understand, or it's a very, very difficult? We need studying carefully and respectfully for understanding each word. For example, we talk about paramattha dhamma. What is dhamma before we can talk about paramattha? Dhamma is whatever is real, because Buddha enlightened whatever is real, especially at that very moment. So paramattha dhamma is now, or dhamma is now, right? But no one understand dhamma as dhamma at all. If that person hasn't heard before about the teachings of the Buddha, can anyone understand whatever appears now as just a conditioned reality arising and falling away for sure? In split seconds. So it's so very deep to consider whatever appears now as not self, right? And this is Dhamma, and the Paramada Dhamma means that its characteristic cannot be changed at all. No one can do anything because it's conditioned to be such and such reality. So Buddha thought about that which is conditioned, arising and falling away. Even him or anyone cannot have anything arise at will. Yeah. So we have to understand, seeing now, is it Dhamma? Who can make it arise? Can anyone control it? Even sound, who knows that there is sound if there is not hearing? So at moment hearing only, that sound manifests itself as a reality, uncontrollable, conditioned. Otherwise, it cannot arise at all. By having moral confidence on reality, which appears now as not self, and it's only Paramada Dhamma, but since so very deep and very subtle, so it is Abhidhamma. So Dhamma itself is Paramada Dhamma and Abhidhamma. And we don't have to label this is seeing, this is hearing, but the seeing sees, no matter who call it seeing or not, and hearing hears, no matter we think that I am hearing, but actually if there is no hearing at all, can there be the idea as I hear? So without Paramada Dhammas, there's nothing at all. For example, the world, we think of the world in different ways, like what is the world? But in reality, if nothing arises, can there be any world or anything? But whenever a reality is conditioned by conditions, not by anyone at all, at that moment, it's the world. So the world is full of many, many moments of conditioned realities arising and falling away in split seconds. Who knows this? The Buddha had enlightened the truth of whatever now appears. And this can be studied to see that this moment is not I or anyone who sees. And seeing just sees, it cannot do anything at all. And when there is confidence on the truth of reality right now, never change. It can become conditions for right awareness with right understanding. Just arises to be aware with understanding of whatever is now appearing. See, no one can do anything. No self who can try, no place to think about, because at this moment, only this moment, can be penetrated with right understanding and right awareness, but not by the idea of self. That's why all the paramis that we have heard before is now at this moment. Patience to be. Study, listen carefully to know that this can be insight. Otherwise, there's no way to eradicate the idea of self at all.
Yes, Ajahn, but you say study, that yeah. means learning Dhammas as the Buddha analyzed. But the problem is, it's just a way of analyzing whether you have 28 rupas or 29 rupas or 35 rupas. It doesn't matter. It's still the realities. But if we know the number 28, does it make us enlightened?
No. Because you see that at this moment, it's not trying to identify seeing as it's accompanied by seven chetasikas at all. But hearing a lot and learning to understand the nature of realities can condition right understanding to understand more and better and clearer to letting go the idea of self.
Yeah, I agree with you on that point. But then the whole idea of 89 chittas and all the numbers doesn't have any meanings.
No meaning, because it's only memory. Mm. So understanding is not memory at all. Understanding is acetasika, and memory is sanya acetasika, see? So sanya cannot penetrate or understand whatever appears. Whatever it arises, it remember, marks the object. That's all. But right understanding cannot arise alone. There must be other cetasikas with moment of understanding. But it's not necessary to think about what are there with understanding. See? So I think that people misunderstand the meaning of study. They think that it reading and memorizing, but that is not understanding or the moment of studying at all. So what is meant by study is any moment when there is no understanding. And then by hearing or thinking, wise considering, can condition understanding. Not just by memorizing the number and not understanding that what is studying is moment of learning to understand reality which is now appearing. But why do we read a lot and learn a lot? Just to condition the understanding of anotherness. The point is at any time, any day, the words of the Buddha condition right understanding on and on. That is the development which people thought that it's bhavana by meditation, but actually it's the development of understanding. Without right understanding from hearing, there will never be condition for sammasati and sammatiti, which is satipatthana, to arise, because it has to be the satyayana, not only understanding the words, but to have very firm confident on the teachings, that it must be the studying of what appears now. If it's not studying whatever appears now, it's only thinking and memorizing while seeing sees, arises and falls away, all conditioned realities now, arising and falling away, and never to arise again in samsara, not only in this life. Otherwise, there's no way to letting go little by little the misunderstanding, the idea of self, from whatever appears. Because the five khandhas, all five, are object of upadana. And how can there be moment of having the moment of penetration of khandha without hearing a lot and understanding more and more about it? All five. So what people take for meditation is just going somewhere. Why? Reality is now appearing. And no one can have sati at will to set it on any object, because sati is also anatta, right? It's conditioned. So who can select object to for sati to be aware? So without studying that reality is now to be understood at any time, while one listens to the teachings carefully, one understands what's meant by Paramada Dhamma or Dhamma. It's not in the book or anywhere, but it's now at moment of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching whatever appears.
And just to relate back what Ajahn was saying to your two questions, about the first one about undermining paññatti, and the second one about meditation techniques. So the Buddha used paññatti to teach, like now we have to use concepts to explain about the Dhamma, and there has to be the understanding conceptually of what is right about realities first, before there can be the direct understanding of Paramatta Dhammas. So there has to be paññatti, which is right intellectual understanding about what is true and real now, right intellectual understanding now about seeing now, thinking now, hearing different dharmas that are anatta. So it's not undermining Paññatti. Without Paññatti, we couldn't operate, we couldn't have this discussion. But the point is that these Paññatti, these concepts about realities, are pointing to the Paramatta Dharmas themselves, pointing to the realities, the Paramatta Dharmas, those Dharmas which have characteristics which cannot be changed. So the reason we study is in order to directly understand the realities. And then the Patipatti, which is the direct understanding, is what leads to Pativeda realization, as Bhante knows. So actually, what is meant by bhavana, or development of understanding, when it is we're talking about understanding of realities, it is Patipatti. And it is the Pariyatti that leads to that Patipatti. But if someone has an idea that they should focus on a particular object or label a reality or try to concentrate or understand, then it's not the right intellectual understanding about conditioned dharmas now as anatta. So it's not undermining Paññatti. Paññatti are essential in order to develop more understanding of Paramatta Dharmas and to understand really what is meant by bhavana, or right practice, because not anyone who can practice at all.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I want to have a very short question. It is a little academic in nature, you know, but I'd like to ask your opinion on that. Recently, a British scholar, Peter Harvey, wrote that Arya Satya, Noble Truth. So he said that the translation truth is wrong. It should be reality, true realities for noble ones. His translation is noble realities, something like that. Because when he studied the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and its Pali usage, he said that, for example, the Buddha didn't say that this is the statement, this is dukkha, is satya. The Buddha didn't say that. What the Buddha said is that this particular five khandhas are dukkha, ariya, satya. So satya here means reality, not truth. So I'd like to know your opinion. Again, this is about what?
Sorry, I'm just, in case you didn't catch the... Did you catch the question, Ajahn, that this scholar prefers the translation for Arya Satya, prefers the translation of noble reality rather than noble truth?
I think we should not cling to the words, so long as we understand that it is about reality now, and the translation, well, we have different translations, but it is always what is appearing now at this moment, is it dukkha or not? It arises or falls away, thus it is dukkha. So we can call it truth or we can call it reality, but it is more what appears now, and then to learn the characteristic of what appears now.
Yeah, so and why do we call this our worldly experience as dukkha. Why do you mean by it is dukkha? Why do you think that this is suffering or painful?
Well, we don't think only of suffering and painful, but the deepest sense is it arises and falls away and never comes back. So it's not worth clinging to. It never returns. And that is the deeper meaning of dukkha, not only pain or painful feeling, but all conditioned realities are dukkha.
How are you reply to Freud? Sigmund Freud, the German, German psychologist. What he said is like this: when something beautiful is impermanent, it doesn't lose its value. Actually, the value rises. It's a value of scarcity. When something is rare, then we value it more. We enjoy it more. So he said that he cannot accept the equivalence of impermanence and painful. So what do you think about that? How do you reply to this argument?
Okay.
Sorry for my pronunciation.
Well, the Buddha's teaching is that it is dhammas that are anicca, dukkha, anatta, right? So he didn't talk about conventional objects as being anicca, dukkha, anatta. That's the first point. When you say we value something more, what does it mean? It means actually we cling. We cling to it. We place more importance on it. Yes, right. But his teaching is that no dhammas are a refuge. No Dhamma can be a refuge.
No Dhamma can be
a refuge.
Something we can rely on.
Something we can rely on. They have
for what?
They have no intrinsic worth. It is in this sense. See, we have to consider the meaning of what the Buddha said. People use the word suffering or impermanence in different ways. But we are considering the way in which it was used by the Buddha. And he was explaining that dhammas have no intrinsic worth or merit. They're not a refuge. They arise and fall away. And although they have a characteristic that can be experienced by panya, they are also empty and fleeting and like a bubble, like a lump of foam, etc. You know the sutta.
Yeah. Then I have one question. So suppose in Christianity or in Islam, they have a eternal hell. So it is not impermanent, it is eternal. So is eternal hell be termed good? Or suppose I'm sick, because this sickness is transient, I will recover. If not, I will suffer eternally. So in this sense, transient is good for me. So why did the Buddha said, yad nityam tan dukkham? Why did the Buddha say that whatever impermanent is suffering or painful? It's my question.
Because there is clinging to what is impermanent.
We may talk about eternal hell or this or that, but as we know, actually, in reality, there are the Arya Satcha. In fact, there are only cheetahs, chetaseekers, and rupas arising and falling away, nothing lasting for an instant. And there is clinging all day from the moment we wake up to khandhas, two realities that arise and falling away. And this is the cause of all problems in life. So the clinging to what arises and falls away is why those realities are unsatisfactory. Because they arise and fall away, they're not worth clinging to. And there is clinging to that which is unsatisfactory, which leads to all kinds of difficulties. So what seems lasting, like this table or anything else, actually is just in our imagination, because there are only cheetahs, cheetah seekers, and rupas that arise and fall away immediately, not worth clinging to at all. Each one, even the greatest panya, is unsatisfactory, not worth clinging to, because it's impermanent as well. And this is why, in the deepest sense, all conditioned realities are not, I forget the expression used earlier about something special or wonderful, but actually they're all asubha or foul, not worth clinging to at all.
Yes, Lita.
Yes.
So, no worth clinging to. So, who decides is it worth clinging or not? Suppose I think that actually, not me. He said, we do then. He said that even if every better is better to fight and lose rather than not to fight at all. So, suppose a person has such an idea. So, how can we argue against him that it is not worth clinging to? Who will decide this is worth or not? For example, Mara, the arch nemesis of the Buddha, he loves samsara. He's happy in samsara. So, what can we say against him? Who has such a belief? So I think, you know, but I'm an academic actually, so maybe this is a kind of academic argument, but sorry for that, but so your answer, what clinging to or no what, who would decide that? If each person decides, each person has a different ideas. Okay.
Well, you're right, each person does have a different idea. I think it's not a, from my understanding, it's not a question of who decides. It's what the Buddha taught. The Buddha, the enlightened one, taught about realities. And among those realities are ignorance and clinging.
Yeah.
And I think if you're looking at who decides, each what we call person has different accumulations, and some have accumulated over many lives understanding. Others have accumulated. Well, we've all accumulated some wrong view, but some have accumulated understanding of what the Buddha taught, of realities, of what is the world, what is it that we conceptually call the world, and were it not for realities arising and falling away, there would be no world. So I think if you're going to start talking about, if we're talking about who decides, we're talking about a lot of wrong view. You raised earlier, you know, the Christians, and I think you said perhaps Muslims talk about, you know, eternal life in hell, etc. That we're looking at what the Buddha taught, not the views of these other religions. And I think it's dangerous to go to other religions to try to work out what the Buddha taught. And that going back to the Buddha's teachings is the only way to realize, to understand about realities, and that life consists of realities.
Here, what I wish to know, this becomes my opinion. That previously, I've been using the other scholars' arguments. Now this becomes my opinion. I would answer my own question. The Buddha said, these impermanent things are not worth clinging to, because he was speaking in terms of Nibbana. It was, Even the term dukkha, suffering itself, I understand this is a relative term. Compared to nirvana, the whole world, our worldly experience, is a giant pain. The word is a whole understand the word the dukkha satya. If you don't know nirvana, you don't really know dukkha satya. Only with comparison to nirvana, we can call that this is not worth clinging. This is not what we say. This is suffering. Even though this is a joyful feeling, this is still pain compared to nirvana. Now this becomes my opinion. Please discuss.
But not many of us that know what nirvana is like. So I always have a feeling that we come to hear Dhamma talk, we come to universities, you come to discussions to talk about realities and nibbanas and paramattas. But it seemed to be impossible to really experience what it is. As I agree with Bhante that only until you know what nibbana is, then you know suffering. Because without like knowing how to feel full, how can you feel hungry? Something like that. So I think it would be interesting that we can hear from Achan and Nina how, by hearing the Dhamma, understanding little by little, we can really experience Nibbana. Because I think that's what we're all looking for. And I'm not sure if anybody among us here, how far we experience Nibbana. And can we teach other people experiencing what maybe we don't? So I would like maybe some elaborations of what Nibbana is like and how to experience it and how can we experience dukkha without knowing what Nibbana is like.
It's also my question.
I think that it's not just the word, for example, dukkha. What is dukkha? See? If there is no reality, can there be dukkha? So if you do not understand the teachings of the Buddha word by word, one word at a time, clearly, it's impossible to understand further about the Noble Truth at all. So when we talk about dukkha, what is dukkha? We remember just the word unsatisfactoriness. But what is it? Is that dukkha now? Because dukkha is the first Ariya Satya. If there is no understanding of dukkha directly, it's impossible to have less and less attachment and clinging to realities. So there is not the way to experience Nibbana, because it's not anyone who can, but the developed, highly developed Panya, which not understanding reality right now at all, even it is dukkha, because seeing is not permanent. It cannot be anyone. It cannot belong to anyone at all. No one can have it at will. Now it sees. How come? At moment of hearing, how come sound? Without conditions, sound cannot appear. Without hearing, sound cannot appear. So sound is not permanent, and hearing is not permanent, seeing is not permanent, that which is seen is not permanent. We begin to understand the meaning of dukkha, that it does mean only unpleasant feeling at all. It is all conditioned reality. Sabbe sankhara anicca. And sabbe sankhara dukkha, according to the impermanency. And sabbe dhamma, including nibbana, anatta. But nibbana does not arise, so it's not dukkha. So we have to be patient and understand the virtues of the Buddha's wisdom so great that without wise considering we fall in trap of our own thinking all the time. For example, just one word like panyati and paramadadhamma, is it now? If it's not now, there's no way to experience the truth, which the Panyati is only the shadow of the image of the arising and falling away of realities. Without realities, there will never be Panyati. So what is meant by Panyati, see, if we study carefully, it has to be this moment. And one learns to understand that there's not yet the fully understanding of what is there in the book or what is now at moment of hearing it. For example, seeing now, everyone sees. No one there. Seeing doesn't belong to anyone. As soon as it sees, it falls away instantly, rapidly, in split seconds. It cannot belong to anyone at all. So if you think that seeing is you, and the eye is you, and everything you take for you, or my body, are all dhammas. That's why we understand that Buddha enlightened Dhamma, and he taught Dhamma realities, and he taught about whatever appears now, like at this moment. What moment is Paramatta Dhamma, and what moment is Panyati? See, it cannot be at the same moment at all. So the moment of seeing what is seen is not Panyati. It's a reality. It's conditioned. And who knows that it arises with the four primary rupas. Without the four primary rupas, there will never be that which can be seen at all. So it's a reality beginning to understand the anattaness from the first word to understand the Pariyatti all along with realities to have more confidence, which will be Satyana. Before there can be condition for Sammasati of the Eightfold Path, Sammaditi, because anyone who does not understand whatever appears now, how can there be the enlightened truth which now seems not permanent? Dukkha must be that which is dukkha. And dukkha here in his teaching of the Arya Sacca must be the impermanency of all conditions, all conditioned realities.
That briefly on to the question of who decides what's worth clinging. We know actually there are just dharmas which arise by conditions. No one there, no one who decides anything. So at a moment of clinging, why is there clinging to yellow and not red? Because there is the accumulated tendency, the accumulated attachment because of sanya, which remembers what attachment likes to cling to, for example. So clinging this way and not that way by conditions, by the accumulation, paktu upanisya pachya. So this is why clinging arises at any moment and clings to a particular object, because that tendency has been accumulated from long, long ago. Just like now we're listening to Ajahn talking about Dhamma, and this listening and considering wisely is a condition for more listening and considering wisely. This tendency also develops. And everyone is interested and has an idea about Nibbana, but the understanding has to begin now to develop and accumulate. So by beginning to consider and understand what really dukkha means in the deepest sense, how seeing now is dukkha because it arises and falls away, panya now is dukkha because it arises and falls away, this is the way that understanding can develop intellectually in the beginning until it can directly understand those realities such as seeing now or hearing now, and then eventually the more developed understanding can understand directly the arising and falling away of those dharmas and so on until it attains, realizes Nibbana. But the understanding has to begin at this moment, and it has to accumulate but not anyone who chooses or selects or can make it happen at all.
Yeah. So you mean that it's not possible to intellectually explain that why anicca is dukkha? Is that so? That is to say, it should be something we learn through that understanding in the moment. Is what you mean?
How can, for example, seeing consciousness now, seeing consciousness arises, experience its object, visible object, falls away instantly. How can that seeing, which arises for an instantly and immediately falls away, how can it be satisfactory?
As I said, if that something that rises and falls away is, suppose my sickness, suppose someone that I hate, then it should be a good thing for me, right? It's my question.
But we are talking about the Dhammas that the Buddha explained about, right?
I agree with and all you said that all the Dhammas are rising and falling. What I mean is that I don't deny about Dhammas rising in a false way or the epidemic processes. Actually, we study them as a Buddhist monks. I accept all of them. No need to argue these things about it. But my question is, why do we maintain that anicca must be dukkha? It's the first question. It must be, so do you mean that it is something to be understood through what we say, developing our wisdom or something that can be intellectually explained? That's my question.
Do we cling to seeing?
Pardon?
Do we cling to seeing? Do we want it to continue?
Sorry, I don't understand.
Do we have attachment to seeing consciousness and hearing?
Again, another question is, why attachment can be so bad?
Well,
why?
I'm trying to answer your first question, though. If we cling to Dhammas and they are impermanent and not worth clinging to, then that is the aspect of unsatisfactoriness, right? You said, why does impermanence mean unsatisfactoriness? The answer is because they are what we cling to. We want them to continue on and on. But they are impermanent. So where is the value in clinging to them?
Then, for the Buddha clings to nothing, right? The Buddha doesn't cling to anything. Then it means that all things impermanent is no longer dukkha for him. Do you mean that?
No, I don't mean that. Because they have the quality of being impermanent still.
Yeah.
And they have the quality of being not self still. And they have the quality of being dukkha still. Because that's a characteristic.
Then clinging is our problem. Not the problem of the Dhamma, right? It's our problem.
Whether of course we cling clinging is a problem.
Problem, yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But why, then how can we be justified in calling it dukkha? Because clinging is our problem, not the Dhamma's problem, right?
But what is the nature of the Dhamma?
Nature of Dhamma is, you have said that the impermanent.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, impermanent.
Not
and,
self.
Not self, and then the dukkha.
Yes.
So my question is about dukkha.
Right.
Why do we call it dukkha?
Because that's what it is. That's the characteristic of it. Unsatisfactory.
Again, I'm still confused. For impermanence, if it's not permanent, it's impermanent. Yeah, understandable. Anatta is, this is another whole problem. You know, there are controversies how to interpret it. But about dukkha, unsatisfactory for us, right?
You are saying that unsatisfactoriness is a subjective
quality rather than an objective one.
It seems to be subjective. Can you suggest another translation?
No.
And any conditioned dharma apart from Lokutra dharmas are the object of clinging. So even, for example, the rupas of the Buddha, no clinging. The Buddha has eradicated clinging, but other people can still cling to those rupas and cry when they fall away. So they're still impermanent and unsatisfactory, and when clung to are the object, are upadana khanda, object of clinging. So that's why when we're talking about the Four Noble Truths, the Arya Satya, only Lokutra dharmas are not included, because Lokutra dharmas like Magga and Pala Citta cannot be the object of clinging, but every other conditioned dharma, even those associated with the Buddha, can be the object of clinging for other people. So they are unsatisfactory. They arise and fall away, and there is clinging to that which is doesn't last an instant.
And I think it has the aspect I mentioned earlier of being of no value, not being a refuge. That is also included in the dukkha quality or characteristic.
Not being a refuge. I mean, refuge for what? For what means that, like that you see? Suppose if I'm sick, a doctor is my refuge. If I want to learn science, a scientist is my refuge. So when you say that Dharma is not a refuge, refuge for what?
We take them as being worthwhile. We do cling to Dhammas, and we value the seeing, the hearing, we value life. But the Buddha's explanation is that everything we value is actually just empty, fleeting, momentary, not self.
I agree with that, and value, worthless.
Yeah. Worthless. So that's the quality of the dukkha.
I can see that.
And also all the examples you give of what may actually be worthwhile, like study of science or the someone you hate or having disease, but these are all long stories about situations that they're not dharmas. For example, at a moment of hating someone, the reality is dosa, and there can be clinging to dosa, so it carries on. So there can be clinging to any paramatta dharma, but as soon as one thinks in terms of, oh, the study of science is worthwhile, it's not understanding paramatta dharmas. So when we talk about the unsatisfactoriness of dharmas, we're talking about paramatta dharmas, because in reality that's all there is that is conditioned, arises and falls away. We're not talking about studying science or having diseases or a long story about hating someone and how it's good when it ends. That's not what the Buddha taught when he taught about the five khandhas. The five khandhas are just referring to the conditioned nature of rupas, vedana, sanya, chetasikas, cittas, which are conditioned, arise and fall away instantly, each one dukkha. So this is why we use panyati, we talk in conventional terms, but there has to be the very clear understanding of the distinction between paramatta dharmas and panyati. Otherwise, it's impossible to ever understand what dukkha is in the deepest sense, or what anicca or anatta are in the deepest sense, because they're referring to absolute realities, dharmas. So that's why at the very beginning, Ajahn said, in the beginning we have to first of all understand what Dharma is. Dharma is reality. It's not hating someone or having a disease or studying science. It's seeing now, visible object now, conditioned realities which are not self, not a thing, not a situation.
Not self, this is another topic of question, but we are still stuck here with the unsatisfactoriness. So the question whether it's a subjective or objective, so if the subject objective, how do we define that? When you say unsatisfactory, we understand it subjectively. Unsatisfactory for you or for me? Is it the way we understand the term?
Well, I think you'll agree that what we are talking about is one of the lakana, right?
Yeah,
characteristics.
Yeah, lakana, yeah.
So,
yeah.
However we understand the term, we have to understand it as a characteristic of a Dhamma. So there's no argument whether it's subjective or objective. It's definitely a characteristic and not...
I agree with that.
Not a perception,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But to understand it, it is a...
Well,
at least for me, you know, it's difficult.
Do we understand even seeing now?
Yeah.
We want to understand all these things, but bit by bit, because the characteristic of Dhammas cannot be understood directly until Dhammas themselves are understood directly. And so this is what we talk about. You said earlier you know all about Dhammas because you studied them. Well,
yeah, but
that is
as
just
I said, you know, I'm academic.
We are talking about a different kind of study here.
Yeah.
We know them from the book, but we don't know them from direct experience, even though they are arising, or certain Dhammas are arising even now as we speak. But are they known by direct experience?
Another question. This is something to be understood through re-understanding, or it can be intellectually explained. It's my another question. So what up to now, what I understand from your answers is that why anicca is dukkha can be understood only when you have real wisdom. Do you mean that? Because impermanence still doesn't logically imply suffering or pain. So if it is to be understood through wisdom, maybe. I don't have that wisdom.
Well, I think there are quite a few things about the teachings that can only be properly understood when understanding has been developed. Obviously, Nibbana is one thing.
Yeah.
So the question, how do we understand Nibbana, is really... it's an unanswerable question for us. We have to start with what can be understood, and what can be understood are the realities that are arising in the present moment. And that's where we always begin, at the beginning. But even we say we understand anicca and anatta, the characteristics, actually we don't. We just have a conceptual understanding. Until Dhammas are understood, then the characteristics can't be properly understood. So I think your comment applies to all the characteristics, really.
Maybe this is something that I still cannot catch up with.
When you say about subjective and objective, what do you mean by subjective? Subjective experience or subjective understanding?
Subjective means that you see, this may be satisfactory for him, not satisfactory for me, but again satisfactory for him. So it depends upon the person, subjective. So objective is whether you like it or not, true for everyone. It's objective.
May I just at the point with Bhante, whether we like it or not, definitely is subjective. And even if it's a universal truth that objective to everybody, I think it's not true either. It's only the one who could understand the conditioned Dhamma that are unsatisfactory can understand what is unsatisfactory. Because as long as Dhammas are conditioned and we are already fettered in that prison without free will, because we want to do certain things, but conditions make things go in another way. Then we have dukkha. So if we understand dhammas as conditioned, then we understand the deep meaning of unsatisfactoriness. But if we just judge on whether this is a subjective or objective criteria, then we could never grasp the true meaning of conditioned dhammas. That's just my little understanding, but I'm not sure if it's correct or not. Yeah.
I tend to agree. I think whether something is subjective or objective is not relevant here, is not the point. I think if when understanding has developed sufficiently that it can know, see dhammas, for instance, seeing or visible object, there's no subjective objective about it. It just is. It's understood. Banya understands it. I'm thinking that talking about subjective, something is subjectively or objectively unsatisfactory or beautiful or whatever, that talks to one to a particular person's accumulations from the past, what they've liked. But it doesn't talk to the understanding of realities. And I think it only distracts from the understanding of realities.
What the Buddha taught are universal truths common to all. So whether one's ever heard the Buddha's teachings or not, then there is clinging to that which arises and falls away. So it's common to all. Attachment is the cause of all problems, common to all. And even when, like in your example of Mara, someone may think they're living happily in samsara, this is ignorance. So is it better to live blissfully in ignorance, or is it better to understand more about the truth and reality now at this moment?
Oh, I'm just wondering if Ajahn could say a few words about the quality of dukkha, the characteristic of dukkha, seeing this is the one that's the sticking point.
We talk about dukkha, but what is it? We don't know dhamma, and we talk about dukkha, see? But is there anything now, right now? Is there anything? What is that?
Realities?
Yeah, just pinpoint, one at a time.
Yeah.
One characteristic at a time.
Yes,
What is there now?
Visible objects, there are sounds, there are dhammas that we take for granted as panyati.
Yeah, just one.
Okay.
Okay, visible object.
For example, visible object.
Whatever you see now is real, isn't it? What is seen now, what is now appearing to seeing now is real. It's a reality.
Yeah, it means that the visible object and the eye consciousness, they are realities now. Do you mean that, yeah?
You talk about visible object, right?
Yeah.
Can we say that no matter we call it what, but it's that which is seen by seeing in truth now, without seeing?
Without seeing, you mean that without seeing, that object doesn't exist?
Cannot appear. Even it's there, it cannot appear. But as soon as it appears, is there any clinging or attachment to it? Because one clings all day long. To what? To seeing and that which is seen, hearing and that which is heard. It doesn't mean that we cling, but we don't know cling to what. But there must be a moment of clinging to whatever is there, right? And does it last? Seeing and that which is seen, or we call it whisper object, or sound or hearing, can they last long?
Well, we think that they last, we think that they last. Because, you know, 5 minutes ago you look like this and now you look this way.
But when we study Abhidhamma, citta arises one moment at a time and it falls away instantly, numerously, uncountable. So now what is seen appears as the image of that which arises and falls away now all the time, right? And the word panyati means that it is known, that which is known, by such and such manner. So now there is Kun Fong or Kun Jonathan, but it's only the nimitta of that which arises and falls away in split seconds, and that is panyati. So when we talk about panyati with our Paramada Dhamma, there cannot be panyati at all. But whenever there is whatever Paramada Dhamma, the arising and falling so very rapidly, what is left is only the image that can be known by such and such nimitta. And that is the meaning of panyati. No word at all, not necessary. As soon as there is seeing this idea of someone, instantly. But Buddha knew better, much better than that, that the visible object, which can be object of seeing only, has fallen away, until what is left is panyati of a glass or the shape and form of reality. That's why we have to have understanding of what is real and what is panyati, so that we can say whether what is dukkha, that which arises and falls away no matter what. So that which is seen or visible object is also dukkha. Not only the feeling is dukkha, whatever arises and falls away. You cling to that which is gone completely. Never will arise again. Never to arise again at all. Is it wise?
Yeah. Technically, we understand that, but
it's not technically,
empirically,
it's a truth.
How can we experience?
It's not how, but one has to understand whether it's true or not, and have confidence in that truth.
Well, I think it's the Buddha's word, so I'm quite confident.
But if it's not,
experiencing it is a big
not yet, not
issue
yet, yet, not yet, because at moment of touching, there is idea all the time, table or my hand or my leg or whatever, but that is not the characteristic of a reality which is conditioned to arise and falls away. We touch many, many times a day, no understanding of it as just a reality. Always panyati, all the time. So panya knows what moment is Paramata Dhamma and what moment is the idea of something which we take it as something is panyati.
So are you suggesting that every time that we in contact with something and we remind ourselves, oh, this is just hardness, this is just softness, this is just
at
visible
moment,
object.
At
is that
moment,
correct practice?
At that moment it's thinking, not okay. The moment of experiencing.
Yeah, but without that thinking, then we completely forget the Buddha's words.
Until even there's no thinking. Mm. The acquaintance of the characteristic of each reality get clearer and clearer, that you need not think about that word, about it, but it's there, and right understanding is there. And you see the difference between the understanding, the intellectual understanding about the story of the hardness here and seeing now, and that which is the direct understanding, which cannot arise at all if there's no right understanding.
Is it true that we always experience two realities, hardness, but the concept of table also arise at the same time?
The concept cannot arise because there must be realities only.
Really?
Arising and falling away until nimitta appear.
I thought that always that the two arise together.
No. Without the Paramada Dhamma, can there be concept arising?
Even when we understand hardness and color, but the concept is sanya, is functions.
So sanya is not you. Sanya also arises and falls away.
Yeah.
An idea is also thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So we study Abhidharma.
Which is a normal function of the mind, which forms concepts. When it has to arise,
yeah,
does
when,
it?
When we talk about citta, it's the faculty of that which experiences an object. It cannot remember, it cannot feel, it cannot like, it cannot dislike, because citta is only that which now experiences. It sees now, it hears now. That is citta.
Mm. But sanya also accompany.
Sanya
because
is
it's one of the seven
universals. That's why Buddha taught in details about realities as citta cannot be sanya, cannot be cetasika. And each cetasika is different. Sanya has to be only that which remembers.
Mm.
Each one is one cetasika at a time. When it arises, it cannot perform the other's function.
Mm.
So no self at all. Before there can be the direct understanding of any reality, it needs a lot of understanding. Not being forgetful that now what appears is real, no one there, no one there, no glass there. Close one's eyes, visible object cannot be seen. No idea about anything can follow, because there's no seeing. But after seeing, since the object arises in split seconds, and the citta which experiences in split seconds, so what is left is like the shape and form. Like we turn on the light of candle or stick, then you move it in this way, and you see a circle of light. See, like now, circle of many, many moments of seeing, hearing, thinking. And without understanding each word deeper and deeper, we'll never understand the wisdom of the Buddha. If we think that we can just read and understand, it's wrong. Because even Dhamma say, whatever is real, we don't have to name it or call it. It's there when there is that which can experience it, and both are all gone completely, not to arise again. And this is samsara. And this is dukkha. Without such understanding, it's not the understanding of dukkha, just thinking about subjective or objective and so on, but actually no word at all when there is the understanding. At moment of the Buddha's enlightenment, there's no word. All realities appear to the very highly developed Panya. But when he taught, because of the enlightenment of the truth so great that he could use any word to represent reality to be understood by those who consider, for example, what is life? If there's nothing at all, no life, but what is taken for life at this moment, seeing, is seeing, no one there. And at moment of seeing, there's no hearing, there's no thinking. So how can there be the enlightened, the truth of seeing as no body, not permanent, no one there? Panya developed from hearing, to know that only whatever appears now can be object of studying. Because studying not is the word in the book, but the word in the book tells about whatever appears. So at moment of talking about citta, now everyone forgets, because the attention paid to that which appears, not the citta which now experiences with cetasikas all the time. So it's like turning up that which is turned down, or that which is covered is opened up.
Hmm.
Because now we live in the world of Panjati. Without Paramada Dhamma, there's no Panjati, but no understanding of Paramada as just that which arises by conditions, arising and falling away so very rapidly. But there is still a characteristic to be understood, to study. So now at this moment of seeing, it's a moment of studying. But it's not directly, because at moment of hearing about seeing, there are many thoughts about something or about seeing or hearing, see? Buddha knew this fact. That's why he taught for 45 years to not letting go, not going astray from whatever appear now at this moment. Before there can be the understanding of the sampajanya, see, it's another level of panya, because now it is only panya with sati, which is intellectual understanding. But it takes quite a long time to not turn away, to study this moment unexpectedly by conditions. No one can have sati to arise. No one can have to have such and such object, because as soon it arises, it experiences. It's not avicca, and it's not clinging. But at that moment, right understanding can understand the characteristic of sati. Because if it's not that level of sati, even there is sati right now, we just talk about it. And we know that at any moment of kusala, there must be sati. But sati does not appear, as any cetasikas do not appear. Even citta experiences an object, there is no understanding. If we just think and think about concept, life, and so on.
Actually, our time is running out. But we can have the last comment, and then we would have to leave, but we would come back and forth with the discussions.
Only one last question. It's about the paramattha and panyati. I see this cup, shape, form, and color. This is visual form. So this is a paramattha, right? But tomorrow, I might remember this cup, the same shape, form, and color. So am I at the time, would I be seeing the paramattha dhamma or panyati dhamma?
It's not the matter of thinking about it, but it's just now what is seen. A cup or visible object?
It's the mind object.
Paramattha dhamma and panyati dhamma should be differentiated, right?
The question was, what is seen now? Is now what is seen visible object or
no? The
past?
Question is, when I remember something that I saw in the past.
Now, Ajahn's question to you is right now, because in the past is gone, tomorrow hasn't come. So right now, what is seen? Now, is visible object seen or is a glass seen at this moment?
She's asking me the question.
What is seen at this moment?
See, at the moment, what I can see is I can only speak from the books. At the time, what we have is the eye consciousness. It's an object, it's that the visual form.
Visual form, that's
yeah,
it.
That's it. Yeah.
And tomorrow, seeing will see visual form. Yesterday, seeing saw visual form. In hell realm, seeing sees visual form. Last life, seeing saw visual form. Seeing only ever sees visual form.
So but visual form is the visual form.
Always, it is just visual form that is seen. But afterwards, there is thinking about shape and form and idea and ideas about glass and people and places. But actually, at this moment of seeing, just one world, only visual form experienced, no matter when or where. And just one comment also back to your earlier point about even when we hear about only this moment, only seeing which sees visual form, because the clinging to self is so strong and the idea of wanting to do something, so as soon as there's an idea of trying to catch the reality or trying to be aware of it, then this is not right practice, because it's actually motivated by an idea of self. So understanding means just developing very naturally understanding at this moment,
only visual form is seen, but not by trying to catch it or label it or be aware of it, not trying to do anything, but just beginning to understand intellectually in the beginning that only visual form is ever seen, only sound is ever heard, only hearing ever hears that sound, only seeing ever sees visual form. And the reason this is important is because if there's no understanding now of what is seen now, what sees now, it's impossible to ever get rid of the idea of I can do, or I can focus on an object, or I can practice, or I can anything.
Sarah, I'm just wondering about the use of the term visual form. Visible object is that which can be seen, and seeing can only see visible object. Seeing, and here's where I'm wondering, seeing does not see shape and form. I'm just concerned about the confusion between visible object and the subsequent shape and form.
I think the Venerable's using this term because it's very common object of rupa, like in the translation they often use visual form as the translation, but one has to be clear that it is just that which is seen, no matter what word or label, just that which is seen, different from an idea of shape or form or glass or anything, just that which is seen.
And it's that visual object which is anicca, dukkha, anatta, not the glass or the table.
Yeah, I...
But whenever there is seeing, there's always the idea of I see something or someone.
Yeah, that idea usually follows almost automatically. Yeah.
Different moments.
Yeah, it is different moments. Yeah.
That's why if there is not the understanding precisely of the difference, there must be always I see someone or I see something. That's why even we have heard a lot about visible object. It's only in memory that we have heard such word, visible object. But whenever there is seeing, it's not just visible object. As we have heard, it's always someone. That's why it takes time to consider what is right and what is not right. Otherwise, it seems like the teachings of the Buddha is so very, very easy. Anyone who here can get rid of the idea of self instantly, but actually it's not. There must be the parami of satya parami and kanti parami. Otherwise, it is so very easy to think that I see only visible object because I think I see visible object. But actually, as long as there is still not conditioned enough to understand that what is visible object? If there is no seeing, it cannot appear at all. So it appears to seeing and to clinging to both seeing and visible object as I see something. And this is what Buddha taught to understand clearly. They are not the same moment at all. Seeing arises and falls away by way of Abhidhamma. After seeing three moments, there is attachment. Lopa mulucitta, kamasuva, opavasuva, or tidasuva, or avichasuva. Before the object has fallen away, how fast life goes on with ignorance, not understanding the succession of the arising and falling away of reality as a fleet of realities, until there is moment of sammasati of the Eightfold Path that no one can have it at will at all, but by understanding more and more without expectation, it can understand moment of beginning to understand seeing at moment of seeing. That is the experiencing, not that which is seen. See, it takes time.
That's why there are three levels of understanding: Pariyatti, Patipatti, and Pativeda, or by way of Satyayana, Kichayana, and Katayana. No one can just jump to experience directly the arising and falling away of realities without Pariyatti.
Okay, thank you very much, Jan and Nina. Actually, my original purpose was just to say greetings to Nina because she was an old friend. But we discussed actually Pali, not Abhidhamma. So this is the first time I got a chance to listen to your group discussions. And so please forgive me if I'm a terrible academic, but thank you very much for your patience.
Will you be joining us at the Buddhist Cultural Center?
I live rather distant. I cannot. That's why I chose to come today, to especially meet her. Yeah, to meet her actually. Yes, old friend. Okay.
Thank you
very much. Thanks to all.
When I came in this morning to the waiting area at the airport, you were discussing thinking with mana and thinking of self and how frequently it arises, and we often aren't aware of it. Nina, I think you and Ajahn were talking quite a lot. Can you tell me a bit about that discussion? This morning when I came into the waiting at the area at the airport, you were talking about moments with mana and moments of thinking with, you know, thinking of self and oh, okay. Sarah?
How can they treat one like this? Or some, that was one example.
In the hotel, that I or was how, angry.
Or how, why me or something? Or was that it about mine?
That's it.
It was something.
Yeah,
some
we talked about my impatience last night. Because at the hotel they were too slow to look at my credit card. And Sarah said to me, Kanti, patience. And it made it worse. So there's a lot of mana. Then I think of this person and me, and I am not treated well. And that way, yeah, we discussed that. Some problems in daily life.
Mana then is any time thinking of one's own importance, the importance of one another's. It's not just
that
comparative
so
situations,
yeah.
The self being important.
Yes, yeah.
Waving the banner, it's me that's important, or yes. I could have arranged it better, or why do they do it this way and not that way, or something like that. I think there were some other examples discussed, but I forget.
It was good to hear it, and I couldn't quite catch it all, which is why I was asking. Because most of the time, I'm important. Unless we consider that, we're unaware of it.
One topic we discussed a little bit on Saturday, you were asking about discussions on Saturday, and one very small discussion in passing was about, for example, if one's complaining about something and then it's thinking about oneself, no metta, so one can say when there's mana, it's one's own self-importance, no consideration or metta at that time, at those times, or no patience at all. So that was what I gave the reminder, because we'd had that discussion about no patience, no metta, when it's all about me and
about Satyapanya, and that we know so little. And Sarah said, as an example, I and my Satyapanya, which I like, I and my sati and panya, like it's ours. I found that a good expression to explain that. Trying to work it out, that is what we quite often discuss.
That happens often.
To find out. Yeah, but is this already direct awareness or only on the level of Pariyatti, or is the level of Pariyatti also direct awareness beginning or not? And we try to work it out. And we talk, yeah, that's what Ajahn said, when we talk about something that doesn't arise now. So that leads us away from the present moment by thinking. That was a very good point.
Right. It was a point about very good point. Yeah. Like trying to work out some detail about Pachya, trying to work it out, always being led astray.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's just attachment, but actually there's an idea of self. It's a kind of wrong practice because there's the idea actually behind it that I can work it out. So it's not the understanding of conditioned dharmas at this moment, like I can work out what the pachaya are by thinking about it, not understanding
I can
that
and I will. Yeah.
Not understanding that it's just thinking that's conditioned now. So always being led astray by the idea of I can work it out.
So we talk about it in an abstract way rather than a more study of this moment. So we are led away all the time.
There can be, we are led away, true, but there can also be some understanding arising during the course of being led away if there are conditions. There are conditions if it arises, yeah. Yeah, I'm familiar with the banya, the moment of banya, you know, at some level, may arise, and shortly after, my banya.
And if understanding doesn't arise at that moment, or this moment, like being led astray now by thinking, if it doesn't arise at the moment when it occurs, then those realities will never be known, exactly, the ditti at that moment, the clinging to self at that moment will never be known if understanding, so any time is the right time for understanding.
So you refer to the ditti at that moment of being led astray. Maybe ditti, maybe not.
But at the moment of, this was like the moment of having the idea that one can work out
can
the
work
detail.
Yes,
or
yes, yes.
A moment of, and of course it's much can be much more subtle. Now, thinking about what is that particular condition and whether this is included in that. So it's not actually an idea of I can work it out,
no.
But it's there.
It's very subtle. The wrong practice aspect is very subtle, isn't it? Very, very subtle.
The question about hardness and space. Okay, this is something that you've mentioned many times. Whatever you call hardness, there must be spaces in between, so it cannot be as hard as it seems when it's directly experienced, because now nothing is known about the space between the kalapas with hardness. And so the rupa of space must be understood in order to understand that what we take for something very concrete is not like that because of space. And so the group of rupas with space in between must be directly experienced stage by stage in the development of understanding, because at first it's impossible to experience the reality which arises and falls away. So the importance of understanding the space between the kalapas and why understanding has to develop to directly know it.
Just to understand the truth, little by little, whether is there space in between kalapas.
That's all. Because now it seems that what is touched is very hard, and so when there's
more developed understanding and more is understood about how actually it's just such a momentary hardness that arises in the kalapa and falls away, so that it's not as hard as it seems, just to understand more and more about reality.
When there is the understanding of space in between kalapas, right? No one deny that it has to be. This is thinking or intellectual understanding, but there must be. But do we mind to experience it directly, or remembering that it's not either this or that, not my body, not microphone or anything, just learn to understand reality as not anything like we used to take it for. That's all. And then panya grows and grows, like now they're seeing, but what is seen? See, theoretically, everyone says that seeing is not the idea of taking the shape and form as something. So seeing itself arises to see. And the citta, after that, arises to experience the same object, but not seeing. See, it shows that it's much more than we can think about. Each citta, as it arises and performs its function differently from time to time, and only 3 moments after seeing, which after moment of seeing, sampatthicchana does not see, santarana does not see, and vottapanna does not see, but they experience the same object as seeing, and it can condition attachment or aversion. And so in the Sutta, Buddha didn't teach about seeing and sampatthicchana, santarana, vottapanna at all, because no one knows about it, right? As much as one can see, it's only after seeing there is attachment or aversion. So no need to talk about the 3 moments before attachment or aversion, but to learn to know that no one can do anything. It's the way it is. Citta has to arise and fall away in succession with different cetasikas and different functions. That's all. To learn to understand about the anatta-ness, so that whenever there is conditions enough to understand that what is seen is only that which is seen. No one in it, nothing in it. It is the way to begin to see that there is no self, nothing at all. Only realities which can be experienced through different doorways, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. And after that, there is the idea of concept, just thinking, taking it for people and things. Even after enlightenment, up to the degree of arahata, there must be the idea, concept of that which is seen, but no wrong view about realities at all. See? That's why we have to understand panyati, that it follows the process of experiencing the absolute reality. No one can stop the way it is.
And I think also on that point about the space, I think it helps to appreciate that actually many, many hardnesses that are experienced, not just one, or it's...
Even thinking about to experience it is a trap of lobha. Yeah. Expecting when, and just understands and understands and understands. It's the only way to do not go astray from seeing right now. What is hurt is the characteristic of seeing, which sees, that's all. So, is the garden now, place, yeah, wall, chair. So one begins to understand what is meant by living alone. No one, only the experiencing of an object at different times. Seeing is not me. See, hearing is not me. Actually, there's no one who lives alone. only different realities. So right understanding develops from the beginning, on and on and on, to have more confidence on whatever appears by understanding. And sati by itself, by conditions. And this is the way to have less attachment to whatever one is used to, attached to. Otherwise, if one tries and tries very hard, it's impossible to have less attachment to wanting to know. There is the I who just want to know. So it's quite a long time, but beginning to understand parami, the 10 parami, satya, this is so true, no other way at all. And adidana parami, see? Adidana.
Like at a moment of understanding.
Because seeing, see, it's not me. Seeing, see, it's not thinking.
Seeing, see, is not me. That which is seen, visible object, nothing, no one in it. That kind of resolution, that forms up with thinking, right? Pardon? With right
your understanding.
Thinking with intellectual understanding, okay.
Without this, there's no condition for direct understanding. Because at moment of direct understanding is exactly the same as one has heard before about it. Like no one there.
Yeah.
No world at all. Only a reality, just one right then. And that which experiences begin to manifest as no rupa in it at all. Whatever experiences is that which is the faculty of experiencing.
So you say no rupa in it. It's the beginning of experiencing for the visible object and seeing, the understanding of seeing.
Oh, that which experiences.
Is that which is experiences.
Which is different from that which is experienced.
Yes, because without the understanding, we think there is rupa.
So at this moment is the world of that which is experienced, while citta and cetasika arises and falls away all the time, unknowingly. Until there's more and more understanding of citta, or cetasika as not self, then it can appear, manifest itself to the panya, which is developed enough to experience such no one and no world, only the experiencing and that which is experienced.
Not wavering or moving away from understanding reality now is the adhidhana, the right resolution.
Distracted all the time, because now we think of the rain and the people are running around here to tidy up things. So we think a lot of all those things. But this is a condition too.
Indicates that not enough condition for direct awareness yet.
I again.
This question means there is no understanding of Dhamma at all. Only hearing about the words. The story of Dhamma, but not the understanding of a Dhamma.
I'd never thought of adhidhana being, you know, beginning with thinking, now there's seeing, there's visible object, there was no one in it. There must be seeing because I think I'm seeing. And I could only think I'm seeing if seeing is arising. And no one in it.
And right understanding understands that. But if it's not right understanding, one would like to know the way to understand this.
There's no other way than listening. Yeah, then little by little understanding. Listening and
for, because there are many kinds of adhitana, but for adhitana to be a parami, it has to be with right understanding, because it has to be resolved or determined, or it has to not waver from understanding reality at this moment. But without right understanding, there cannot be adhitana as a parami in that way.
That's right. And without an adhitana arises by conditions. There's nothing we can do it. I mean, I, you know, there's this, the mind has this sneaking temptation to go, okay, I'll be resolved. But that's not it at all. That's wrong thinking, wrong understanding, wrong practice.
When there's no idea that I can do, at that moment, it's the understanding of Dhamma as Dhamma, but still, attachment is there, and intention to understand is there, but Panya can understand everything as it is. But when there's no Panya, it's again, try, or the idea of I would like to understand, but not how can I. This is different.
And that's where patience comes in.
Satya, being truthful to understand what is real now. How, when it's out, how can I? It is ditti, so being truthful about what is the reality at this moment. Even if one's talking about Dharma.
Yeah. As Dharma is so very subtle and very difficult, people cannot get it. That's why there are meditation centers all over the world.
Sounds so strange now to listen to somebody who likes to go to a meditation center or is looking for a practice. I had a conversation with somebody the other day in a shop, somebody that I knew quite well at that shop. And it's wonderful being able to discuss in this group, because there is a, you know, there's some common general understanding of the usefulness of discussion and developing understanding, and the opposite with regards to meditation and the like. But it's almost frightening to listen to somebody talking about, well, I've tried this and I've looked at that. I like this and I like that. And I'm learning how to empty my mind, and I'm, you know, it's very difficult.
Didn't say, how can I?
Well, I think they can, very philosophically based to some extent. You know, comparing, there was comparisons with religions and Freud, and I found myself wondering about, oh my goodness, what's it like to be at a university studying Buddhism?
Or they might think that I know already.
Yes.
So no question like, how can I?
Yes, true. Or not admit it anyway.
Even right now, with our sati, what is seen? or with someone and something. So intellectual understanding, that is not true. Because the truth is that what is seen cannot be anything at all. This is the way to have less attachment to the idea of something or someone.
Well, that's the way of putting it. We hear nothing in it, no person, no thing in it. But what is seen as nothing at all, that's even better.
Dual
object.
Yeah. Otherwise we won't know what Buddha enlightened.
No person, no thing, invisible object, just visible object, only that which can be seen.
Just that which is seen.
Just that which is seen,
yeah. It doesn't matter about the name or the label in the end.
No,
just
that which is seen
at this moment.
And nothing in it at all. That kind of says it all, doesn't it?